Today's class is entitled, How to Handle Issues, from Proverbs 25, 2 to 15.
I'm not sure how far we'll get through. I'm going to try and get through to verse 15, and if possible, perhaps a little further, so that we try and capture the spirit of the chapter as a whole. And you'll remember that we've already said the theme, we believe, of this particular chapter is how to handle issues. This is the key idea that unlocks the chapter. First of all, then, a breakup of the chapter, and we'll see the wisdom of this, hopefully, as we go along. Now, you'll remember that Proverbs 25, verse 1, is itself an introduction to the whole section. So, therefore, the proper beginning of this particular chapter is Proverbs 25, verse 2. And we believe that Proverbs 25, verses 2 to 7, we might entitle Conduct at the Royal Court. Now, most of these divisions are my own. There are one or two phrases that have been drawn from other writings, but I think that's a pretty good summary of those particular verses. So verses 2 to 7, conduct at the royal court. And then verses 8 to 10, how to resolve differences. How to resolve differences. And that leads naturally into the next section, which is verses 11 to 15, which we might entitle, The Need to Find the Right Approach. The Need to Find the Right Approach. And then finally, by contrast with that, a very large section running from verse 16 right through to the end of the chapter, verse 28, which is really the inverse of the previous one. It's the need to avoid the wrong approach. The need to avoid, and as I think a lesson in that, you see that there are twice as many things to avoid, says that section, as there are right things to learn. You'll see the wisdom of those divisions as we proceed. So, Proverbs 25, then in verse 2, let us begin. It is, says the proverb, the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. Of course, this is a very famous proverb and well known to us all, but did you know that there is actually a deliberate paralleling of thoughts here in the record. You see the word glory in verse 2, it's the same word translated honor later in the verse. And the word thing in the same verse is the same word translated matter at the end of the verse. So that really what we've got in this proverb is a sort of what we might call a Hebrew parallelism. So if we were to translate that, it would be something along these lines. The word thing, by the way, is the Hebrew word dabar, D-A-B-A-R, which is one of the common words for word. So translating it, we would have as follows. It is the glory of God to conceal a word, but the glory of kings is to search out a word. So there's a parallel of ideas here. It's true, isn't it, that you see, what we're being told here is that God in his wisdom and in his greatness does not leave all of the gems of the truth on the surface of the scriptural record. He asks us to dig deep for them, to search for them as for hid treasure. Remember these words in Romans. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments. And his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counselor? Romans 11, verses 33 and 34. So the riches of God are unsearchable in the sense that they have been concealed in the divine record. But, says the proverb, it's the glory of kings to search those things out. So a king, those that desire to be kings, have to have that spirit of inquiry. And of course, I think this takes us back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, which we won't turn up, but you'll remember the reference there from verses 18 to 20, where it says what? It says why? The king, every king, was to write out their own copy of the law, so that they might search out the word. So this spirit of inquiry, to learn the principles of divine truth, was part of the art of becoming a king. Because only in the word will a person find those principles of ruling by superior mental knowledge, the knowledge of divine principles. Only in the scriptures will those superior principles be found. And therefore, if a man or a woman wishes to learn the spirit of wise rulership, they'll only find it by searching out the word of the scriptures. That's where kings had to go, you see. And yet, for all of that, verse 3 says, the heaven for height and the earth for depth and the heart of kings is unsearchable. You see, it's almost a sort of a contrast here with the previous verse, you see. They've got to search out the things of the truth for themselves, and yet their own heart, in a sense, is unsearchable. A number of other translations make the connection clear. The Revised Standard Version says, for example, in verse 3, as the heaven for height and as the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable. So there's a comparison here being made, you see. Now, you see, what we're being told, I believe, in the third verse is that many of the king's purposes are beyond the comprehension of the mass of his subjects. A king doesn't set forth all his mind. A king doesn't reveal all his purpose. There's not wisdom in that. There are many things that may be in the plan of a king that it would not be wise to reveal, and so a king must learn to frame his counsels with caution. He needs to have some reserve with regard to the things that he talks about. He needs to learn to keep counsel with himself. Mind you, of course, there is a difference, isn't there, between learning to keep counsel and being deliberately secretive. The proverb is not encouraging that we ought to develop a secretive spirit, simply that there are times in life when it's not wise to blurt everything out. Kings don't blurt everything out, says the proverb. They're careful. But they're not secretive. In fact, to be secretive encourages all the wrong things, of course, doesn't it? Secrecy, in that sense, can shelter wickedness and evil that could accumulate at the royal court. We don't want any of that. And so the next proverb, in fact, says that sort of secrecy is not to be encouraged. That sort of development of evil thoughts is not to occur. Verse 4 says, take away the dross from the silver, and there shall come forth a vessel for the finer. Take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne shall be established in righteousness. Now, here are two proverbs that we really need to read together, don't we? You see the word take away, verse 4, which is obviously being paralleled with the word take away in verse 5. So the one is the literal, verse 4, and then the symbolic application, verse 5. So verse 4 says that if we take away the dross from the silver, then it will emerge wholly purified or shining with purity, as the words of verse 4 means. Now, how do we purify the silver? Well, of course, we purify it, we purge it of all impurities, we remove the dross by fire so that the purity of the silver may be revealed. Well, says verse 5, that's got to be applied in a symbolic sense here. Take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne shall be established in righteousness. So the wicked of verse 5 would really be equivalent to the dross of verse 4, wouldn't it? The wicked of verse 5 equaled the dross of verse 4 that need to be purged away that the silver might be seen in its purity. Now, you'll remember that we saw application of this in Solomon's own life. Remember at the time his kingdom was established. And away from his presence were taken all the wicked ones, that his throne might be established in righteousness. Of course, you see, I think the lesson of this proverb is that when it says take away, verse 5, who does the taking away? And the answer is, the king himself must do that. Come and have a look at Proverbs chapter 20. This is the responsibility of the king himself. When we talk about the purification of the silver here, the taking away of the dross of the wicked, that the throne might be established in righteousness, this is an exhortation to the king himself. That's his job. That's his responsibility. Now, Proverbs 20 says, for example, in verse 8, a king that sitteth in the throne of judgment scattereth away all evil with his eyes. And again, in verse 26, a wise king scattereth the wicked and bringeth the weal over them. So you see, who has to purge the dross from the silver at the royal court? And the answer is the king himself. It's his job to remove those influences that may corrupt the purity of his reign. Now, of course, it's difficult to do that in the ecclesia, isn't it? We can't simply say, well, you're out and you're out and you're a wicked person, so be gone. It doesn't work quite as simply as that. Does it? So how do we apply the principle of Proverbs 25 and verse 5 in ecclesial life? Well, I think the answer is this. What's the principle of verse 5? The principle is this, that the king is responsible for maintaining the purity of the royal environment. He must not allow wrong influences to corrupt how he rules. And I suppose it begins firstly in our own lives. We've got to purge the wicked things, the wicked principles, the wicked thoughts from our own lives in order that the throne might be established in righteousness. Those who aspire to positions of rulership in the age to come must have learned to purge the dross from their own lives. And if each one of us did that, and faithfully did so, then much of the difficulties in ecclesial life would be gone as well. And yet there is a time also in ecclesial life when the time may come, the need may come, to purge out the wicked. And from time to time, reluctantly, and only after much effort, that moment of time may come when a person is purged in that sense from the ecclesia. But the Spirit is one that we apply, of course, firstly, in our own lives and in our own hearts. And maybe because the king does have the power to purge the wicked from his presence, maybe because of that, we have a connection with the thoughts of verse 6 and verse 7, which go on to say, therefore, put not forth thyself in the presence of the king, and stand not in the place of great men. For better it is that it be said unto thee, come up thither, than that thou shouldest be put lower in the presence of the prince. Now, again, we've got two verses here that really need to be read in conjunction with one another. And what's the spirit of these two verses? Well, the New International Version says, do not exalt yourself, for verse 6. The Revised Standard Version says, do not put yourself forward. The Jerusalem Bible says, do not give yourself airs. So what's the spirit of verse 6? Well, the spirit is this. It's the eagerness of those who desire the outward show of authority, but who have a manifest incapacity for the discharge of authority. Those who aspire to kingship, but who in fact are inadequate to the task or the responsibilities of kingship. We ought not to have that spirit, says the Proverbs. We don't put ourselves forward for positions of rulership in that way. This is the spirit of those who desire authority but are not deserving of it. Remember the words of the third epistle of John, verse 9, and it talks about one there who loves to have the preeminence, says the epistle. Do you remember those words? That's the spirit of this proverb, isn't it? The sense of putting oneself forward to be in charge, to have authority. No, says the proverb, we will commend ourselves as those who are worthy of rulership by a far better spirit than that. And the spirit that we ought to show is the spirit of verse 7, and that is, far better that it be said unto thee, come up thither, than that thou shouldest be put lower in the presence of the prince. Now, unfortunately, because of time constraints, we haven't got time to take this verse and expand it. But do you know that that verse, verse 7, becomes the basis of the Lord's parable in Luke 14, verses 7 to 11? The story of a man invited to a feast, who was invited to come up thither, and one that was put lower, remember? And you'll find that all the words of that parable in Luke 14 are drawn from Proverbs 25. And the Lord took that verse and expanded it into a whole story in Luke chapter 14, which, by the way, suggests another fruitful line of study, and that's this. I believe that every parable of Christ had a proverb as its root. Now there's a line of Bible study, is to find the root of the proverb from whence sprang the parable of the Lord. And here's the root of his parable in Luke chapter 14. It's Proverbs 25 verse 7. And you know how that parable ends up that the Lord says, and it's the spirit really of the Proverbs, he says at the end of that parable, for whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased. Whosoever exalteth himself. And isn't that the spirit here of Proverbs? The man that puts himself forward, the man that thinks that he is worthy of the authority. No, the person who's worthy of authority is the one of Proverbs 22 and verse 29. This is the spirit that we ought rather to show for those who desire positions of rulership. Proverbs 22 and verse 29. It's not the pushing of ourselves forward that will secure favor. It's this spirit. Proverbs 22:29. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men. So the skillful and thoughtful execution of one's duties will commend oneself to the royal approval. And in due time, if we are deemed to be worthy because of the faithful execution of earlier tasks, then it may be in due time that we are given greater responsibility. So Proverbs 25 goes on now to say, in the 8th to 10th verses of this is really the heart, if you like, of this chapter, that the fact that those that desire to rule wisely and to exercise authority, one of the greatest things that they must learn is how to handle issues. And here it is. Now, by the way, you notice at the end of verse 7 that it says, whom thine eyes have seen. Now, that phrase, whom thine eyes have seen, really belong more properly to the beginning of verse 8. In other words, verse 7 should read like this. Better it is that it be said unto thee, come up thither, than that thou shouldest be put lower in the presence of the prince. Full stop, end of verse. And then verse 8 starts by saying, either whom or what thine eyes have seen, go not forth hastily to strive. So those words belong to the 8th verse. And the word strive here has the sense of a trial or a judicial scene. The Revised Standard Version says, do not bring hastily into court. The Jerusalem Bible says, do not come out with too quickly at the trial. So the spirit of the verse is this, that our eyes have seen something, and immediately that person goes rushing off to bring that person into judgment. Don't do that, says the book. Kings learn not to do that. Now, by the way, if you were going to read verse 8, let me give you a moment or two to read verse 8. Tell me what you think the key word is. The key word. What's the key word, do you think? We're going to be warned here about something. Something that we ought not to do. Hastily. That's right. That's the spirit, isn't it? It's the hasty spirit of the one who rushes off to judgment too early because of what his eyes have seen. You know, this happens in ecclesial life, you know. We see brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so doing something, you think, well. And before you know it, we've gone off and we've said to brother so-and-so, you know, I thought, no, and I don't agree with that. And they say, is that right? Well, I don't agree. And before we know it, we've not only convened a jury, appointed ourselves as judge, but we've already held the case and pronounced the verdict, and the brother doesn't even know about it yet. We've been far, far too hasty, says the prophet. Now, come and have a look at Proverbs 18. Proverbs 18, verse 30. He that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame to him. And again in verse 17. He that is first in his own cause seemeth just, but his neighbor comes and searches him out. The New American Standard Bible says for verse 17, the first to plead his cause seems just until another comes and examines him. And you see, this is the problem, isn't it, with rushing off hastily in matters of judgment. Imagine now that we have convened the court and the eyes have seen something, and so now the court scene is held, and along comes the complainant. And so he's invited to make his case. He says, well, I saw brother so-and-so doing such and such and so-and-so, and that's what I think. And if that's what he did, then I really feel that that's wrong. I do. And you listen to him, you think, well, if that's what's happened, that certainly seems just. And then the court invites the defendant to present himself and to make his case. And the defendant arrives and stands up and he says, well, what was seen isn't actually the full story at all. Let me tell you what really happened. And in fact, what was happened was this and that, and then followed by this and that, and that's actually what really happened, you see. And then everyone says, well, that really puts quite a different complexion on it, doesn't it? And the answer is, yes, it does. And the first person's cause that seemed to be just is only until the defendant comes and examines him, and all of a sudden he finds he's been far too hasty. So come back to Proverbs 25, because you see, this is the lesson, I think. You see, this is the spirit of kings. Kings learn this principle, and that's this. You never judge others until you have heard both sides of the argument. Kings learn to do that. And may I say this, brothers and sisters, whatever the circumstance and whatever the matter, you will find that there are always two sides to the argument. You may not always agree with one of those sides. You may not always think that the other side is correct, but there is always two sides. And wise kings learn to hear both before they ever, ever consider making a judgment in a matter. Don't ever make hasty judgments is surely the lesson of this verse. And you see what it goes on to talk about in the ninth verse. It's the same spirit, isn't it? Debate thy cause with thy neighbour himself, and discover not a secret to another, lest he that heareth it put thee to shame, and thine infamy turn away. Debate thy cause with thy neighbour himself. And by the way, I've underlined the word himself, even though it's in italics, because that's really the spirit of the verse, isn't it? The point is, debating the cause with the neighbour himself, rather than discovering a secret to another. The contrast is between himself and another. So the moral of the verse is all to do with personal dealings in matters of controversy. Whenever there's a difficulty, whenever there's a problem, says the proverb, go and deal with the matter privately. Debate thy cause with thy neighbour himself, says the proverb. Now, do you know that that is the very foundation stone of the Lord's teaching on reconciliation? This is the absolute foundation stone of Christ's own teaching on the spirit of reconciliation. Allow me to ask you an interesting question. What is the great chapter of reconciliation in the context of the Lord's teaching? Matthew 18. Firstly, an excellent answer. And secondly, a good one, because sometimes Matthew 18 is quoted to us, isn't it, as the chapter on disfellowship. It's not the chapter on disfellowship. It's the Lord's teaching on reconciliation. And if you look at the spirit of that chapter, that is undeniably so. Now, just come and have a look at Matthew 18 for a moment and see the spirit, therefore, of Proverbs 25 established. Debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another, was the lesson of the proverb. Isn't that exactly what Christ says in Matthew 18 and verse 15? Moreover, he says, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault. Now here it is, between thee and him alone. That's the spirit of Proverbs, isn't it? Between thee and him alone. Now, what's the objective? What's the objective of the discussion? What's the objective of debating the cause with the neighbor? Verse 15, if he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. And you see, that's the real reason why we ought to be entering into discussion with any of our brethren anyway. If there's a cause to be debated, it's for this purpose, isn't it? That we might win our brother. Well, says the Lord, you'll best win brethren when you talk to them privately. You certainly won't win your brother if you denounce them publicly. So come back to Proverbs and chapter 25. By the way, that spirit was found in the law of Moses. We again haven't got time to look it up, but the basis of all of this was Leviticus 19, verses 15 to 18. Which says that one was not to grudge against one's neighbour, one was not to be evil towards one's neighbour, one was not to be a talebearer against one's neighbour, one was in fact to love one's neighbour as oneself. And that's the spirit of it all. So in Proverbs 25 then, and reading now from the next verse, which is verse 10, which sort of marks the end of that section, really. It says, debate thy cause with thy neighbour himself, and discover not a secret to another, lest he that heareth it put thee to shame, and thine infamy turn not away. So the lesson of the 10th verse is that to run to the law, or to run to other people with information, is to run away from the duty that we have of personal relationships with one another. And those who have criticized others publicly in ecclesial life, only to find that their story is counted to be wrong in the end, will find that it turns upon themselves. They're the only ones, finally, that get hurt, aren't they? One translation says, thine ill repute endure, for the words, thine infamy turn not away. They're the only person that are going to be shamed as a result of this wrong approach to the matter. Now, this is all obvious stuff, really, isn't it, brothers and sisters? And yet, isn't it surprising? You know, I think this is one of the greatest areas where we fall down in ecclesial life. I think this is one of the largest principles where we fail to uphold the matter of divine principle. Because it's so easy, you see, isn't it? You see, we know what ought to be done, but a brother and sister comes to us and says, did you know that brother so-and-so did such and such? And it's so easy for us to say, really? Tell me more. What we should be doing is making a stand on the basis that we desire to learn the secret of kings. And that stand should therefore be this: how happy would ecclesias be if every time there was a problem between brethren, this happened, a brother or sister comes up to you and says, do you know that I think brother so-and-so has done something wrong? And before they carry on, you say, well, excuse me, brother, have you spoken on the matter to the brother? Well, no, I haven't. Well, then I don't want to hear anything else about it. Go and debate thy cause with thy neighbour himself. Isn't that what we should do? Shouldn't we make that stand and say, I don't want to hear complaints about others when the spirit of kings has not been shown? Go and debate him. Go and debate thy cause with thy neighbour himself. After all, of course, you see, what's the motive? That's the real test, isn't it? What's the motive of all this? Now, you see, if the motive of the person making the criticism is really just to criticise anyway and not to restore harmony, then who are they most likely to make their complaints to? If their motive is not genuine and all they want to do is criticise anyway, then they are most likely to speak to others who cannot refute what they say. And rarely. Now, you see how that leads on to the next section in Proverbs chapter 25, so naturally and beautifully. Because, you see, verses 11 to 15, we've entitled that The Need to Find the Right Approach. Now, look at the key words. Look how they jump out of the text now. Verse 11, a word fitly spoken. Verse 12, a wise reprover. Verse 13, a faithful messenger. Verse 15, a soft tongue. You see, these are all the principles of those who have learned the right approach to handle issues. And the spirit of every one of these verses is finding the right approach for the particular circumstance that is involved. Verse 11 says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. Actually, I think that's similar to Proverbs 15. If you come back to chapter 15 for a moment and to the 23rd verse, it's the same spirit really as this verse, isn't it? What's a word fitly spoken? Well, isn't it the word of Proverbs 15 verse 23? A man hath joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. Isn't that the fitly spoken word of Proverbs 25, verse 11? Now you see, therefore the spirit of verse 11 is, the right word in the right place at the right time. Wise kings learn to do that, you see. because they are always interested in securing the best result. And I think the lesson of these verses is that, you see, it's the result that's important. And therefore, if you believe that you're right on an issue in life, right on an issue in the truth, you also have a responsibility to find the right approach so that you can secure the right result. It's not enough to simply be right on the matter. We must also be correct in the spirit of our approach. And therefore, the fitly spoken word of verse 11 shows the fruits of tried faith in the setting of redemption. That's the objective of it all. Verse 12, as an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. Now, of course, it does say here that the ear is obedient, and we're going to come later on in our studies to the spirit of learning to accept rebuke. But you notice that the idea in verse 12 here is not on the spirit so much of the person who accepts rebuke, although their ear is obedient, but on learning to be a wise reprover. You know, it's terribly hard to give wise reproof, isn't it? It demands wisdom and tact and humility of spirit in order for wise reproof to be given. But, says the proverb, if it can be done, why, it's like an ornament of fine gold. Those who've learnt the secret of being able to administer wise reproof are like those who have ornaments of fine gold. You see, again, what we're saying is there's an objective to the reproof, isn't it? And the objective is best secured by the right approach. It's the style of the words that are employed. Verse 13, is the cold of snow in the time of harvest, so is a faithful messenger to them that send him, for he refresheth the soul of his masters. So he's a faithful messenger, not just a messenger. You see, the responsibility of a messenger is to speak the truth. That's the idea behind faithful, isn't it? That he must speak the truth, that he must be a faithful and proper representation of the spirit of his master. He'll only refresh the soul of his masters if he's faithfully delivered the message that his master wishes him to deliver. And in order to secure the right result, the results, the message must be faithful. We've all heard about the dangers of messages being blurred along the way. You know, remember the famous one, send reinforcements, we're going to advance, was the cry at the front of the army. And by the time it got to the back, it was send three and fourpence, we're going to advance. And somewhere in the middle, the message got lost. You see, these are faithful messengers. And the reason why the soul of the master is refreshed is because the message is faithfully carried wherever it is so that the right result may be achieved. Of course, by way of contrast with that, look at the man of verse 14. The one who boasts himself of a false gift is like clouds and wind without rain. The word gift here, by the way, means a present, not a talent, not a talent that the person has. I'm not saying that he's a gifted person, but the man who boasts himself of a false present. The Revised Standard Version says, a man who boasts of a gift he does not give. And there are some like that with regard to their words. They have all the appearance. All the sound is right, the noise is right, but somehow the substance isn't there. It's a gift that never really materializes. Well, kings can't use those sorts of people, and he can't use that sort of approach. That never ever does really resolve differences. Just the right noise, without the right substance of words, is not actually a good way to handle issues. But verse 15 is, because verse 15 says, by long forbearing is a prince persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bone. So you see, this is the spirit of quiet persistence, isn't it? A refusal to be provoked. This is the lesson that a gentle and tactful approach will often achieve a result that a heated argument could never achieve. Now, Wycliffe made an interesting observation on this proverb when he said, the tongue breaketh bones, though itself has none. It's a paradox, isn't it? And isn't there another similar proverb? What's the similar proverb to this? Not a soft tongue that breaketh the bone, but a soft answer turneth away, or we say rot in New Zealand. Rot, my English friends here, turneth away anger. But the effect's the same, isn't it? So you see, what's the lesson of verses 11 to 15? The lesson is the same throughout, that in each case, the object of the message is achieved because of the right approach taken. That's the key, isn't it? Wise rulers learn to find the right approach that will best handle the issues of life. Now, we're running short of time, but I thought we might just try and skip into the next section. I'll just tiptoe through two or three proverbs so that you can see the counterpart. Because, you see, I think verses 16 to 28 is now a section about the things that we've got to avoid, those things that don't help, those things that will not resolve issues. It's all the negative things to be avoided. And, well, you can see them all here. Look, let me just summarize them for you. Verse 16, the indulgent person. Verse 17, the smothering neighbor. Verse 18, the false witness. Verse 19, the unfaithful man. Verse 20, the thoughtless friend. Verse 23, the slanderous tongue. Verse 24, the scolding woman. Verse 26, the compromising spirit. Verse 27, the self-seeking person. Verse 28, the unrestrained person. These are all they who cannot resolve issues, who will never find the right way so that differences can be properly handled for the good of the kingdom. And wise rulers learn that none of these methods will in fact work. Let's look at just two or three of them by way of illustration. Verse 18, a man that bears false witness against his neighbor. You know, that was actually the ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments, wasn't it? Thou shalt not bear false witness. It's extensively dealt with in the book of Proverbs. And obviously, from the number of times it's mentioned in the book of Proverbs, it's clear that it's a spirit that we are all susceptible to. You know what the spirit of verse 18 is? It's the spirit of character defamation. Defaming the character of others. And the lesson of this verse is that it may be very satisfying to the flesh to be able to hit a brother over the head with a maul or a sword or a sharp arrow. I think, by the way, there's a progression of thought there. You see, what happens is when you bear false witness against a brother, you start off with a concocted story, and you start off by hitting him with a maul. And that's good, that feels really good, but it's not enough. And so then you get out a sword, and away you go, slash, slash, cut, cut. And before you know it, you've got so enthused with defaming his character that finally you get a sharp arrow and stab him to the heart, and it's all over, and he's gone. You've killed him. It's a sort of terrible thing that grows from within, the bearing of false witness against our neighbour. And the lesson of that verse is that we can never solve problems that way. That'll never resolve differences in ecclesial life, will it? The spirit of defaming the character of others. What about the man of verse 20? The tactless friend. Is he that taketh away a garment in cold weather, and is vinegar upon nitre, so is he that singeth songs to an heavy heart. You see the phrase, vinegar upon nitre? In the Septuagint version, that reads, the word nitre reads as the word, well, it's actually in the Hebrew, the word scab, instead of the word nitre. So that what we've got in verse 20 is, the man that takes away the garment in cold weather, the man that pours vinegar upon a scab, and the man that sings songs to the heavy heart. So what's the spirit of all of those? So here's a person that says, I'm feeling, you know, it's actually a winter's day, and I'm feeling hot, I'm feeling feverish. Well, that's all right, we'll take all your outer clothes off. We need to get rid of all these garments, but it's a cold day. There's obviously something else that's the problem. That's not the right solution, is it? Here's a person with a wound. He says, my wound's dry. Well, we'll pour a bit of vinegar on it then. We'll give it moisture. Ever tried to pour vinegar on a wound? Or the person who's just had a dear family member depart, they're dead. They've just been to the funeral, they're sitting at home in the depths of despair, and in comes the friend. Or, you're feeling a bit, we need a bit of bright music, that's what we need, cheer everybody up. These aren't the answers, are they? These are, you see, problems are never solved or difficulties overcome by thoughtless, tactless solutions. It's not the answer. We'll never resolve differences by these sorts of silly things. that have no real and proper thought behind them. What about verse 23? The north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry countenance a backbiting tongue. And by the way, I think the margin is correct, because really the Hebrew should read that the north wind bringeth forth rain. It's the exact opposite to what the authorized version says. The Hebrew word means to bring forth, not to drive away. And so Moffat translates the phrase, and I think rightly so, north winds bring rain, slander, angry looks. That's what slander does. That's what the backbiting tongue does. It brings forth angry looks. And so you see, this is the spirit of the one who loves to do injury to others. You see, this person has not learned the right way to get on with people. And the lesson of verse 23 is that issues can never be resolved by the backbiting tongue in ecclesial life. No, we'll never handle problems that way. What about verse 26? A righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. A righteous man falling down before the wicked. And you know that chapter 10 of Proverbs and verse 11 says that the mouth of the righteous man is a well of life. The mouth of the righteous man is a well of life. But you see what this righteous man has done in verse 26. He falls down before the wicked. Moffat says he yields. Revised Standard Version says he gives way. You see, this is the person who knows the truth and who knows the right principles of the truth, but they have no strength of character to stand for the truth at the right time. They give way to the wicked. You know, wells were terribly important in ancient biblical times, weren't they? Remember the story of Genesis 26, as Isaac moves from place to place, and they digged a well, and they strove with the Philistines concerning that well, and they digged another well. You see, a well was the source of life to people. And you see, the great danger of this particular well in this particular verse is that the purity of the water has been defiled. It will now corrupt others who drink from it. The name is still there. The spring still flows. The person still reassures. He appears to be a righteous man, but there's poison in the water. And all who now drink from this particular well will be infected. And the lesson of the verse is that issues and problems in life cannot be resolved by compromise with evil. You can't do that. That's not the way. That's not the right approach. And finally, verse 28, which says, he that hath no rule over his own city, he that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. You see that word rule there? Most translations would render the word as self-control. He that has no self-control. You see, the person that lacks self-control becomes an easy prey to the enemy. They yield at the first assault on their feelings. There's no restraining walls in their life. So the lesson of the verse is that perhaps more than anything else, above anything else, that the closing thought of this chapter is that self-discipline is the key to the successful handling of all issues. Because you see, the person that's learned self-discipline, he's the one who has the ability to resist temptation. And he's the one who is able to endure provocation. And therefore, that will lead to a better outcome when problems arise. So these are the principles that kings learn, so that they might handle the issues of life for the goodwill of all their people and for the benefit of the kingdom. That spirit, brothers and sisters, of wisdom, enshrined and ennobled by the teaching of our Lord himself in the words of these proverbs, debate thy cause with thy neighbor. himself.